but this is my first time getting to be in your worship space. And I was struck as I came in here, as I often am when I visit a new Unitarian Universalist congregation, by the particularities of this space, what makes it uniquely beautiful and different from every other worship space that I've been in. I've been in a decent number in my time in this field. I want to talk with you today about beauty, and I have a little historical anecdote to get us started. About 3,500 years ago or so, Hatshepsut, who was one of the very few women to rule Egypt as a pharaoh in her own right, undertook something momentous that had not been attempted for hundreds of years, a trade mission to the land of Punt. Now, we don't actually know precisely where Punt was, the place that the Egyptians called Punt, at least. We have some idea. We know that it was definitely somewhere around the Horn of Africa. Just the exact location is ambiguous to us. Not tremendously far from Egypt by modern standards, but a monumental undertaking at a place, at a time and in a place where it was phenomenally difficult and expensive even to build one single sailing ship. The trade mission was apparently successful because it was commemorated with carvings on the walls of Hatshepsut's funerary temple. This is really why we know anything about it at all. And in this tableau, we find a striking image that is nearly unique in all of Egyptian artwork. You see, nearly all artwork from ancient Egypt is heavily stylized. When you see a human body, it is an archetypical human body in the understanding of the culture that created that image. So they tend to be represented as young and slender, regardless of the actual age or actual body type of the persons they're trying to represent. We have real direct documentable evidence of this because the ancient Egyptians very carefully preserved the bodies of their most important leaders. We have many of their mummies, and we can compare the state that they were at the time of death to the images created of them at the state in life, you know, just before that death, and see that even people with thinning hairlines and pot bellies chose to be represented by their artists without those features included. So anyway, this image shows the queen of Punt. And the queen of Punt has a representation that is basically unique in all of the Egyptian artwork that we still have some record of today. Because the queen of Punt's body is ample. It has folds in its skin, and it is represented at a level of detail that basically no other human being in the entire funerary temple of Hatshepsut, possibly very few other human beings in the whole corpus of Egyptian artwork, are represented. You can see the intricacies, the complexities, the details of her body. Now, there is a debate about what exactly this image means. It has been suggested by some that it's a piece of sort of lowbrow political propaganda. The description, that it's, the depiction is meant to be an insult from Hatshepsut to the queen of Punt. But we know essentially nothing about the culture of that country. The records we have about Punt are all from the Egyptian perspective. So it's questionable how much the ancient Egyptians even knew about the country themselves. And other than that, there were things that they wanted, and they went there in order to get them. So another possible explanation is that this is a relatively faithful representation of an actual person's actual body, and that this person may have matched the beauty standard for a woman of power and privilege in her society. Now, in the modern West, which has such narrow expectations of physical beauty, especially for women, this possibility may be hard to imagine for some of us, but I really want to invite you and challenge you to try to imagine a society in which a body could be considered beautiful specifically because of its fatness. What a culture or nation or just an individual person holds to be beautiful can vary wildly. We may try to explain some of the more popular standards with concepts of elegance or symmetry or perceived physical health, but always there are exceptions and contrary cases. It is also an unavoidable truth that for most of the time and space and cultural content accounted for in the current written record of human history, the power to steer and control culture, to make or sponsor or preserve or censor art and expression, has been concentrated in the hands of a relatively small group of people. And that relatively small group has, up until very recently, in much of the world, been made up entirely of men. The film theorist Laura Mulvey coined the term to be looked at-edness to describe the way in which expectations of physical beauty shape and limit the view of women and their bodies in art in the living world, even often within their own selves, within the selfhood of women themselves. So I want to talk with you about the flexibility and the subjective nature of beauty. But before we can dive deeply into that, we first must acknowledge that the power to fully express and to realize our own subjective understanding of what is beautiful is not distributed equally in our society. Indeed, it never has been. So as with anything that matters, any consideration of the high ideals and aspirations we share as a faith, as the faith manifested in this particular community, we will always find ourselves having to return to the question of power, of who has more and who has less, and how our world might be reshaped in the direction of that beautiful ambition. The place in which all are free and empowered to fully experience the worth and dignity inherent in their lives. So, not forgetting about power, but acknowledging it and expanding our circle of consideration, we might say that in considering whether or not a person, an image, a sound, a flavor, or even an idea might rightly be called beautiful, there is no accounting for taste. Yet, if beauty sometimes seems arbitrary or irrational, or at least inconsistent across all people in all places and times, this does nothing to mar or diminish its magnetic attraction for us. Consider the Song of Songs, the book of the Hebrew Bible, which contains a number of lines that might be familiar to some of us, including these. Arise, my love, my fair one, and come away with me. For now the winter is past, the rains are over and gone, the blossoms have appeared in the land, the time of singing has come. The song of the turtle dove is heard in our land. The green figs form on the fig tree, the vines in blossom give off fragrance. Arise, my love, my beautiful one, and come away with me. The work is not simply a celebration of beauty, but an example of the ways in which love and beauty weave together. We have a tendency to love what we find beautiful and to find beautiful that which we love. Much modern biblical scholarship agrees that the Song of Songs was originally not a religious work at all, but written as a piece of love poetry. Yet it has survived for millennia because it has been reinterpreted as an allegory of the love of an individual, a group of people, or even the whole of humanity on one side, and the divine on the other. Adoring, cherishing, yearning for, reaching out towards each other, each in awe and appreciation of the other's beauty. Humankind for the world and its source, and the world itself equally infatuated with humanity. In his novel, The Sirens of Titan, Kurt Vonnegut pauses the larger story to offer an imaginary ecology of the planet Mercury. Mercury, he explains, has a song all its own. There's no atmosphere, so the song exists only by a vibration in the substance of the planet itself. It isn't heard so much as it is felt. Down below the planet's surface, there are caverns that glow with a phosphorescent yellow light. And here live that world's only inhabitants. The creatures are incredible, flat, diamond-shaped things. They cling to the walls, listening to the sound of Mercury with their bodies and feeding from its vibrations. As the yellow light of the caverns passes through their impossibly thin bodies, it changes from a bright yellow to a vibrant aquamarine. For the benefit of no one in particular, for there is normally no being in those caverns with the capacity of sight, they arrange themselves into complex and beautiful geometric patterns, creating gorgeous displays of light, color, and shape simply out of instinct. This species is intelligent, but they have no experience of hunger or fear, no need for religion or war. Once humans first encounter them, they call them harmoniums because they are so naturally harmonious. Their language has only two declarations in it, and the one always elicits the other in reply, in a constant cycle of call and response. One harmonium expresses over and over again, "Here I am, here I am, here I am, here I am." And the answer comes back, "So glad that you are, so glad that you are, so glad that you are, so glad that you are." As Vonnegut observes through the narrative voice, nature is a wonderful thing. Of course, here Vonnegut is simply imagining, through a flight of science fiction fantasy, a new example to add to the grand and glorious list of exquisitely beautiful things which may be found in the natural world. From the height of the Horsehead Nebula on down to a double rainbow in the sky, two otters holding hands as they float, or the way in which trees in sufficient proximity may interweave their roots in order to share water and nutrients with each other. But if these all seem like easy and uncontroversial examples of beauty, nature has no shortage of more complicated sensations to consider. In some parts of East Asia, especially in tightly enclosed public spaces, such as a train or a bus, you may find a distinctive sign that is mixed in with placards declaring things like no smoking and no pets. The image on it is the middle universal no sign, right? That circle with a stripe through it. And in the circle is a silhouette of a rough oval with a very jagged, pointy perimeter. This is a no durian sign. Durian is a fruit common in Southeast Asia. Eating it can sometimes be a finable offense, even in places where eating and drinking in general is allowed, because the smell of a durian is probably the most divisive scent among all fruits eaten by humans anywhere on Earth. Descriptions of the smell often make comparisons to skunk, cream cheese, body odor, rotting onions, and turpentine. Yet among those who have actually eaten the custard-like interior of the fruit, which I confess I have not, there are many loyal champions of its distinctive flavor. There wouldn't have to be rules against it if there weren't a large number of people in the parts of the world where that fruit is grown who would like to be able to go about their day in public enjoying the taste of this notoriously smelly fruit. Because we're talking today in part about the subjectivity of beauty, its being, as is so often said, in the eye of the beholder, there is an obscure but relevant point of interest that I have to relate. Now, I am a big fan of the Dungeons & Dragons role-playing game. I have been ever since I was first taught to play the game as a tween at a Unitarian Universalist summer camp. And a lot of the creatures and monsters associated with D&D are familiar from legend and folklore. Elves, goblins, trolls, dragons, of course. But there are some that are truly unique to that system of collective storytelling. And one of the most famous and recognizable of these is the Beholder. You might almost be able to guess its appearance from the name alone. The creature is an enormous floating sphere with a single huge eye on the front and a grotesque grinning mouth below that. Above that central eye are several more smaller ones perched atop its head on stalks, twisting and peering about in all directions. I didn't put the image on the screen here in case some of you are prone to having nightmares, but an image will be provided on the credits screen at the end. So if you hang around and watch the image roll to the end, you will get to see one of the illustrations of this monster. Now, the fact that it's made up mostly of eyes isn't the only thing about the Beholder that is well matched to its name, because beholders are universally devoted to beauty. Devoted might actually be an understatement. Violently obsessed with beauty might be more accurate. You see, each and every beholder has an inherent sense that it is the best and most beautiful exemplar of its species, that its stalks are arranged in just the right way, that its eyes are precisely the right combination of colors, that the wrinkles in its skin flex and bend at the perfect places. Every beholder understands itself to be the most beautiful thing in the universe. And for this reason, it cannot tolerate the existence of any other living thing, even and especially other beholders. This seems to me to point to something true, that it is possible to adore a beautiful thing to an excess which is destructive to our own health or the health and well-being of others. And that possibly the easiest thing to adore in this destructive way is our own self. Yet if there is a love for beauty which can exceed the good, it still does not mean that the appreciation for beautiful things is an impediment to right thought or right action, or even that it is not essential to both of these things. The tradition says that when the Buddha attained full enlightenment, it was at the very end of night as he looked up and beheld the morning star. Zen priest Kurt Spellmeyer points out that Siddhartha had almost certainly seen this star many times before, but now he was seeing it in a new way for the first time. The beauty of it changed not because of some difference in the star, but because of a difference in the one beholding the star. The Buddha is said to have said that the Dharma, the teaching that he was driven to share is beautiful at the beginning, beautiful in the middle, and beautiful at the end. The perspective of a practitioner necessarily changes profoundly over time if they come to understand and appreciate the impermanence of all things and gradually dissolve their attachments to the same. But the Buddha's affirmation about the presence of beauty on each step toward enlightenment, the connection between his own moment of total realization and an observation of the natural world, seems to me to make clear that the emptying of the self, called for in deep Buddhist practice, doesn't mean a renunciation of beauty, only an evolution of it. Practicing non-attachment does not mean no longer experiencing anything as beautiful. Here is Kurt Spellmeyer's explanation of this. The world we take for granted, with its gardens and flowers, arises through an artistry not our own, from a place deeper than thought. And we participate in that artistry when we recognize the visible as part of an invisible whole. There, form and emptiness, as Zen tradition says, are like the matching halves of a broken coin joined together at last. If this is not the same as the eternal debate about whether a joke can be funny after you explain it, or whether a thing can be beautiful after you interrogate its beauty, then I think the questions are at least related. The famous and notorious theoretical physicist Richard Feynman once spoke in an interview about how exploring the why underlying the perceptible world magnified his sense of awe and his appreciation for beauty. Here's what he said. I have a friend who's an artist and has sometimes taken a view which I don't agree with very well. He'll hold up a flower and say, look how beautiful it is. And I'll agree. Then he says, I, as an artist, can see how beautiful this is, but you, as a scientist, take this all apart. It becomes a very dull thing. So taking issue here with his friend's premise, Feynman explained, although I may not be quite as refined aesthetically as he is, I can appreciate the beauty of a flower. At the same time, I see much more about the flower than he sees. I could imagine the cells in there, the complicated actions inside, which also have a beauty. I mean, it's not just beauty at this dimension, at 1 centimeter. There's also beauty at smaller dimensions, the inner structure, also the processes, the fact that the colors in the flower evolved in order to attract insects to pollinate it is interesting. It means the insects can see the color. It adds a question. Does this aesthetic sense also exist in the lower forms? Why is it aesthetic? All kinds of interesting questions, which the scientific knowledge only adds to the excitement. The mystery and the awe of the flower, it only adds. I don't understand how it subtracts. Scientific inquiry has, in fact, taught us that some insects, bees, for example, can see a range of light that is not visible to us. You or I, some of us at least, and a bee might be drawn to the same daffodil as one example. But what we might see and what the bee would see in examining the same flower would be considerably different. And this is just one of an inordinate number of ways in which it is possible for different beings to find the same thing beautiful for entirely different reasons. The great weaver of words, Annie Dillard, so famously said, we are here to abet creation and to witness to it, to notice each thing so that each thing gets noticed. Together, we notice not only each mountain shadow and each stone on the beach, but we notice each other's beautiful face and complex nature. so the creation need not play to an empty house. If I do not yet fully understand the function of witnessing the morning star in the enlightenment of the Buddha, I try to forgive myself this limitation, as I am profoundly aware every moment of every hour that I have not yet attained enlightenment. But there is a holiness that I find in our shared human capacity to appreciate the beautiful, each from our own perspective, each to our own particular taste. And it is that expressed very well by Dillard's words, to notice each thing so that each thing gets noticed. Or to frame it in terms of Kurt Vonnegut's words from earlier, to truly recognize the beauty in anything, an object, an event, another person, even our own selves, is to begin a reciprocal dialogue that nurtures and supports all involved. Here I am. Here I am. Here I am. Here I am. So glad that you are. So glad that you are. So glad that you are. So glad that you are.